So we're steeped in this kind of courtly culture. Do you see what I mean? They were writing from a particular moment in South Asian history where republicanism, democracy suddenly became the way to go. It's incredible, actually, how far and how creative and how radical Sikh politics was in a time of extreme danger. Sadhguru rocks up with an army to help Ranjit Singh invade Lahore, right? And his mom's sending him cannonballs to take with him. But actually, that again speaks to us of the fluidity of these gender norms from this period, right? And there's a sense of it's a very prosperous time, you know? And you really see that reflected in the levels of charity and education and in trade that goes on. This is a febrile political atmosphere at all times. He's competitive. He's ruthlessly competitive. The way he sidelines other Punjabis, you know, who he once leaned on for help is harsh. No one foresaw that Gorakh and Nonihal would die within 17 months of Ranjit Singh himself. That was a killer blow.
What's going on, everyone? It's Ramblings of a Sikh here with another podcast episode. Today, we're welcoming back Dr. Priya Atwal, and we're discussing her book, Royals and Rebels, and breaking it down chapter by chapter. We'll also be discussing topics such as how would you define the socio-political system at the time of the missiles and under Maharaja Ranjit Singh? What was the role of women in the court of Maharaja Ranjit Singh? What was Maharaja Ranjit Singh's engagement like with the East Indian Company and in the larger political landscape, both externally and internally? Why did the Sikh kingdom or the Sukha Chakya dynasty fall apart? How big is Punjab during Maharaja Ranjit Singh's rule, and a lot more? Quickly before we start, you'll notice that I appear a little more frequently throughout this podcast than I would do usually, and honestly, it's a complete accident. The Zoom recording decided to do what it wanted, and it didn't separate us both. It doesn't affect the quality in any way, but then again, you have to put up with me appearing on your screen a little more often than usual and a few ad-libs. Anyway, I will stop rambling on. Let's get straight into it and welcome our guests back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Anna. It's been lovely to see the reaction to the first one. I didn't realise we'd get quite such a keen audience, and it's nice to be back.
Yeah, no, definitely. Neither did I. I'm obviously pleasantly surprised. And I think it goes to show that actually there's a great appetite for the work you're doing, but equally it goes to show people are obviously very interested. So last time we kind of jumped from your PhD straight into kind of the Dogra brothers, kind of more of the controversial aspects of the empire. So we looked at who Rani Jindan is, who the Dogra brothers are, kind of the treachery from the Dogras in particular, Lal Singh, etc. Today we're kind of gonna go through the other bits that we missed out. So chapter one deals with the kind of the Punjabi Sikh relationship, political ideology such as monarchy, republicanism, and democracy. I was going to ask you, in a nutshell, could you describe kind of this, the changing relationship with these ideas during Guru Gobind Singh Ji's time and then onwards? Because I read something the other day which piqued my interest, and so I will ask you about that after, but could we start with that, please?
I'm curious to know what you read. maybe we can come back to that then. Maybe I should throw questions back at you. Maybe I should answer your questions. So I guess, you know what, when I was writing Royals and Rebels, the first chapter was really the hardest one to write. Mostly because when you're writing about the gurus, you don't want to get anything wrong. Mm. And also, you know, as the first bit of the Mool Mantra says, is like, we're never going to know everything. So trying to sketch out that history or the ideas of the gurus, it takes you into a level of depth, both historical and spiritual, that is very profound. So, you know, when I wrote that chapter, I was like, I'm just a mere mortal here trying to summarize the richness of Sikh political thought. But I needed to give that chapter because for all readers, there was some big, and for myself, there was some questions about, you know, where does Ranjit Singh come from as a Maharaja and setting up a kingdom and an empire? Like, what is the context to this? Because, and why does he set it up as a monarchy? And there were questions within the kind of wider existing historical literature, the historiography, about the Sikh relationship to monarchy. And essentially, like, there was no original new research that I based that chapter on, that first chapter on. It's kind of engaging instead with the texture of the debates that lie within our existing scholarship that had been produced up to that point. But what struck me, I remember while I was doing my PhD, and I think what led to me writing this chapter was there was two specific questions. One was, yeah, the fact that I needed to provide an introduction, and particularly for non-Sikh readers, they needed to know, okay, who are the gurus? What is going on in the Punjab at this time? What is the broader kind of socio-political context of India or pre-colonial India? And then who is Ranjit Singh and how does he come into the mix? But then within a more specific historiography question, when you look at the popular biographies of Ranjit Singh that the vast majority of readers will have picked up, that are the easiest, most available reads, are Khushwant Singh's books and Budwant Singh's books. And both of those carry a narrative that, you know, implies that Ranjit Singh was a reluctant monarchist, a reluctant king, right? I was like, this doesn't really add up, you know? No. And that also this a broader argument that Sikhi is a republican faith. And I was like, okay, this is an interesting argument, but where's the actual historical evidence for this?
Yeah, where's the evidence?
Yeah, and maybe it's a kind of a sort of an equivalency in taking the idea of egalitarianism that we have within the Khalsa Panth, within the Sikh Panth at large, and translating that into the best equivalent word in English, which is republicanism. But actually, when you look at what the political tradition of republicanism is, and you look at the way that Sikhi operates and the language that we find in Gurbani and in Sikh political practice, actually all the kind of, you know, metaphors and language that we use is very royal, it's very monarchical, even if it's subversive to the idea of what a king does, right? Or the centrality of a king. So we're steeped in this kind of courtly culture, you see what I mean? But the gurus aren't just kind of like aping the Mughals or other Indian kings of that time. They're doing something very interesting with it. And actually throughout the subcontinent, from then to now, you know, even today still, in different parts of the region, people of peasant or definitely not upper class backgrounds anyway, yeah, have experimented with that kind of courtly language and that kind of courtly practice to do all sorts of radical political and spiritual things, right? To make these different claims for the people at large. And so I was like, well, actually, yeah, we can still see Ranjit Singh as a king. We can still see him as a conqueror, but we have to see him within this kind of really intellectually quite fluid and creative culture.
Yeah.
And so that was what that first chapter for me was all about, is looking at the kind of ways in which gurus kind of gave their own vision of the world, of the universe, of the Punjab, of their people, but how they radically played with ideas of monarchy, and how this, you know, playfulness was still, and revolutionary behavior, of course, is in flux the right way up to Ranjit Singh's time and during and after. So I just kind of, in the end, wanted to paint a picture that showed some of that fluidity, but also didn't say this is definitely what happened. It's just that this is the sense that we're getting today, you know, and we've been debating about this amongst ourselves. But also to put the arguments and the ideas and the narratives of people like Khushwant Singh and Budwant Singh into their own historical context, because I think actually they were writing from a particular moment in South Asian history where republicanism, democracy suddenly became the way to go. And they had a moment in which to drive that forward, you know, with the ending of the British Raj. But sometimes we take these ideas and we stretch them back and say, no, this is what Sikhi has always been about, but it's not the case, you know?
No, definitely. The reason why that question was so interesting is obviously, as you rightfully said, there isn't much literature solely on this topic. So for anyone, even from a non-Sikh background, to read that first chapter is really insightful and really interesting anyway. But then the other and this actually happened like I think on the weekend or maybe just like on Thursday or Friday. So there's a company in America who are working on like a strategy based game. It's similar to like what's the franchise called? I think it's called like Total War or something. It's kind of like you're in control of like an empire or an army or whatever, and like you get to conquer the world and whatnot. And so they're creating a very similar version, but it's based on, I think it's based in or around India and like the remainder of the subcontinent. And they're including Sikh characters like Bhai Gurdas Ji, Baba Buddha Ji, Bhai Mardana, etc. And they like, so they wanted me to help write some of their blurbs for this. They were then asking about characters during the missile period. And one of their questions or a number of their questions was about like, how does the Sikh community function during the missile period or post Guru Gobind Singh Ji? Because this was something that he was struggling with. And so I started to do some reading and I'll dig it out and I'll share it. But the thing that got me thinking, so I've always viewed the missile period as a period of reluctant brotherhood almost. So until I read about some of the internal conflicts between some of the missiles, the idea that you kind of get given is all of these missiles are competing for some type of territory, but as soon as there's a common enemy, everything gets dropped. But then I was reading this thing and it was basically talking about how each one of the missiles was essentially its their own monarch. And I know it sounds like the difference is very subtle. But for me, it changed everything, because then instead of looking at Punjab at that time or that part of North India at that time as being some type of like federation of Sikh states, you're actually looking at, it's almost like looking at a map of Europe during the same period and going, well, actually, these are all separate kingdoms, which then brings in the idea of it being a monarchy or not. And to be fair, from everything that I could see, Ranjit Singh and some of the others embody being a monarch. They embody, like they like Jasa Singh Ahluwalia does the same, Jasa Singh Ramgarhia does the same, all of these big missiles do the same. So if you were to try and define the missile period or kind of the period prior to Ranjit Singh becoming the kind of the one who came out on top, although he doesn't do it himself, but how would you best define that as a political system? Perhaps you can't define it, I don't know how it works, but like what would you say about that period? Like how would you describe what's happening and how it functions?
I'll be completely honest, I have yet to go in great detail and read the sources of that period in Punjabi and Persian and Braj Bhasha. So until I have, I will not offer any kind of definition, because it's not fair or appropriate in any way, shape or form. But I think the sense that I get in a general sense is that it's like a crucible of political experimentation in a period of intense. It's incredible actually how far and how creative and how radical Sikh politics was in a time of extreme danger. You know, the community was, you know, of course, on the run from Afghans, from hostile local governors, both Mughal and Punjabi native, but yet was fired by the vision of the gurus, particularly Guru Gobind Singh Ji, as we know. I would say also, we can't sweep over the internal vision that was there, and that is something that I think as a community we have to reconcile with, that throughout our history we have never entirely been united as a community. We've always had a lot of internal debate, dissension, disagreement, yet somehow still also manage to come together when there is an external threat. And I think it's just that kind of making and breaking that's constantly going on. And that fluidity is something really, really fascinating. And I think, you know, there's a lesson that we can learn from that today even with my relatively imperfect knowledge, I think that that we don't need to necessarily be uniform in order for our bonds to be united, you know? If anything, it's so human for us to be so messy and complicated.
Yeah.
Yet somehow we're still united by the lessons that the gurus left for us. So, I mean, there's a real, this is the thing, we tend to overlook just how much power struggle there was going on amongst Sikhs, you know, amongst ourselves in this period, which is why you have missile on missile wars going on.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the first two chapters, the second chapter, I couldn't, you know, when I was mapping out the arguments that go on within Ranjit Singh's own family as he builds his kingdom, I'm like, God, this is enough for any kind of Star Plus drama, you know what I mean? And they did obviously make one, but it's insane just how much brother on brother violence goes on and this kind of stuff, right? So you can see why our families are in such a mess today. But like, it's also a kind of a phase of where we're really learning how to build our own polities.
Yes.
Our own governments and rule in our own way, you know? And yeah, it is like, you could compare it to any other kind of continental politics. Anyway,
yeah.
Because the Punjab at that time, you know, it was a vast region. So yeah, there's lots going on. I think it's a messy time, I would say,
yes,
but also
definitely.
A very fruitful one.
Yeah, no, definitely. I really appreciate the way that you answer the questions, because it's like so honest and just like, and you give everything. So you're like, well, I can't actually comment on it because I haven't looked at the sources. And I just love it. I really appreciate that. So with chapter two, you know, I've read like a whole host of things that are quite helpful in terms of setting the empire apart. For instance, the lack of a zemindar, but you also challenge the assumption that women are unmarshaled. So for instance, Punjabi queens being involved in diplomacy, women's involvement in military campaigns, and the daily trappings of Ranjit's court. Just even like Sadako, like I was reading about how Ranjit Singh would call upon her to turn up with her army essentially in order to go to battle. So yeah, completely can understand where you're coming from. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that and give us kind of a couple of examples of what we've just spoken about?
So in the second chapter, basically, I outlined an argument or a kind of a story arc about this, about Ranjit Singh's family and his rise to power as a Maharaja. And you're right in what you said earlier, that actually, you know, all of these other Mithil leaders, the Sardarnis, are acting as monarchs, essentially. I mean, actually, he's not the first to take on the title of Maharaja. Jasa Singh Ahluwalia had done so earlier on. And so Sardar, you know, is operating essentially as a Maharani, even though we don't call her as such. We refer to her typically more as Sardarni Sardar. So if Ranjit Singh's going to come to power, he comes to power as a king amongst equals. But then if you think about the very names that we have taken on since Guru Gobind Singh and the rise of the Khalsa, Singh and Kaur, that's there already. Whether you have it in your title that precedes your name, it doesn't matter. What comes as your surname does the trick, right?
Yeah.
So that's that. But it's what I leverage as a term for that chapter and for the book as a whole is a term that came up in a book that I read about an early modern European dynasty, the House of Orange-Nassau, which eventually takes over the Netherlands and the Dutch Empire, written by two Western historians. But nevertheless, the term's very useful, dynastic colonialism. And it's a very open-ended term, but it's the idea of a dynasty, of a ruling house, a kind of a family lineage, that takes control of a monarchy or in a kind of a duchy type fashion, and that they control an empire, or that they engage in a form of colonialism that might be a way of using soft power over a region, right? Even if they're not necessarily the rulers, they kind of use it as a form of soft power to expand their influence in a kind of a national and a global way. And I think that really applies to the way that the Maharaja's setup develops, because, and that's what I tried to piece together in this chapter, is it's not just about, I mean, one of the main things is how he kind of leans on his family relationships to help him stabilize his sort of mini fiefdom that the Sukha Chakia missile have in the northwest of Punjab around Gujranwala, and then how they kind of expand around that. But also, you know, he's clearly recognized as being a talented young man. Yeah. You know, like there's no doubt about that. The fact that Muslim citizens of Lahore call on him, even the Afghans lean on him for support when they're trying to exit the Punjab. And he's shrewd enough to be like, okay, I'll cut deals left, right, and center, right? But that Sadaq War arranges the match with his mother. Yeah. And then despite the fact that her husband's died in battle, yeah, with Deep Singh's father, I mean, it's just insane. But it's also amazing how she puts that grief aside and, yeah, like, let's make this work. So the family politics, but also the family support system around him, I was building on the argument that the very esteemed Sikh scholar J.S. Gurewal had made, you know, decades before, that Ranjit Singh's not a Superman.
No.
He's leaning on the work that his father and grandfather have done for him already. And I was like, well, actually, you know, we need to think about the women and the kids in this family too, because when you start looking through the sources, you know, obviously I spoke in the previous episode about how I was fascinated with the Maharani, his last Maharani, Jinder Kaur, but she's the last in a long line of women that do a lot of work for him, essentially. And not just talking about childbirth and being his wife, but actually running the kingdom. And so, you know, when I, to kind of, you know, draw a link between that episode and this question, when I started looking into the life of Maharani Jinder Kaur, you know, it was interesting how she engages in a form of gender politics to manage her role as the queen regent for her son, Dilip Singh, when he's just a little boy and he's the Maharaja of the kingdom. And what was interesting was how the British were constantly asking of her, what is the source of her authority? How come she's so powerful, right? What precedent is there for this woman to be in charge of the show, right?
It's how dare she? Yeah, yeah.
Exactly, right? They're, yeah, like, what's going on? And so I was like, well, let me ask the same question of the sources. What is going on? And as you go through, you know, the sources of this period, you may only find snippets of information. So like you just said, Sadaq War turns up with an army. I was like, wait, where is she turning up with an army from? What is, if you, because it's often just the one line,
yeah,
that you get, yeah, here and there, right? So you'll find my book is just peppered with these one-liners or the odd name mentioned here or there. That's really vague, right? And I'm like, who is this talking about? Who is this woman? But they're doing the most interesting things, right? So Sadaq War rocks up with an army to help Ranjit Singh invade Lahore, right? And not only does she do that, but she negotiates the peace settlement for him, because he's like, oh, I want to go and carry on conquering and looting the whole bazaar. And she's like, chill, mate. Like,
yeah, relax.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't exactly say it in those words, but we can paraphrase. I would have loved it if she had done. That would have been a historical revelation.
Just relax, isn't it?
Like, better, man. That would be more like what she said. But yeah, you know, you get these fragments. And then later on, there's his second wife, mine again. So Ranjit Singh marries Sadagor's daughter, Mehtab Kaur, is his first wife. And then within a few years, he's married again to a lady called Raj Kaur, who then has her name rechanged to Dadar Kaur because Ranjit Singh's mother was Raj Kaur. And then she becomes known as Mine Again because she's a daughter of the Nakai missile. So not only does Ranjit Singh have the troops of Sadaq Kaur with him from the Ganeya missile, but he also has the troops of the Nakai missile with him from his second marriage, right? And it's with them that he goes to conquer Lahore, okay? But then later on, Mine Again has his first son, Garak Singh. So that kind of gives Sadaq Kaur a bit of a boot, a Mehtab Kaur, because they haven't produced a son for him. Mine Again kind of starts to take over in the rankings because she's produced an heir. But also Shia is very active herself. Later on, you know, in coming chapters, you see how she's very heavily involved the education of her son, Garak Singh, the heir to the throne, the prince, how he gets sent off on military campaigns, not on his own, but he's only about 6 years old when he starts going, which is insane enough.
Still, it
is.
Yeah.
You know, don't go to school one day, go to war, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Take a 4G, you know, General Sardar's with you. And he learns the hard way, basically. He has to go and manage these campaigns. And his mom's sending him cannonballs to take with him. And grain and also, it's not just pack your lunchbox and go to primary school. It's like, no, take this cannonball and off you go and fight, right? And go and capture that fort, and then I'm going to live in it afterwards. That's literally how this goes down. So, you know, when you get these odd sentences and you start compiling them, you realize that these women are so active, right? And Ranjit Singh, okay, he might be campaigning somewhere in, you know, around Amritsar or around Kashmir or Multan or whatever, and then the women and the sons are off somewhere else. And then you've got other sardars, other generals, Hari Singh Nalwa, Akali Fula Singh, all of these characters who are part of the fabric of the military and the politics of that time, they're all working away under Ranjit Singh's rule, you know? And he's very carefully managing his political relationships with all of these people. But where the kind of dynastic colonialism part comes in for me is how these very different family relations are set up as ambassadors and as kingdom builders on behalf of this new lineage that Ranjit Singh is establishing as the front runners in Punjabi politics, right? How they all have to toe the line with the kind of political agenda that he's setting up. And that meant that he decides, he prunes off the various branches of the family that don't align with this vision that he has for the future. And, you know, it's this project that this family, you know, and it grows. He as the kingdom grows, he marries more women, 30 wives in the end, and then his son have another 13. So it just, and they've come from all different backgrounds, all different class, caste, whatever, and different parts of the region. So, and then they all have roles to play as well. So it's just an ever-expanding family business, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. But even with, like, just to kind of add on to that, like what we were saying earlier about how viewing Punjab as kind of like any continent, like especially, the only reason I reference Europe is because of how much you have to learn about European history at school and at university, etc. And so I don't mean to make those comparisons for no reason, but it feels like that. And especially when you talk about him marrying these women in order to kind of, like to kind of consolidate power or to consolidate his army or whatever.
It's a very fair point that you made there, and I completely understand for a diaspora audience, this is the kind of framework we've been given to work in, right? For our history education, very Eurocentric. But actually, I spent some time reading around polygamous marriage or diplomatic royal marriages for this period of research. And Europe is actually the exception to the norm. You're absolutely right that European monarchs made these kind of political marriages around, you know, the different European states. And Queen Victoria is the kind of queen, literally the queen Dudley of this, right?
Yeah, setting up their kids left, right, and center.
Yeah. Yeah. Left, right, and center, she was marrying off Anjani. But actually, monogamy is the norm in Europe, right? Yeah. Due to Christianity. So, okay, Henry VIII, we know at school, married 6 wives, but he had to divorce them or behead them or do something to them.
And had to create his own church in order to do that. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Ranjit Singh did none of that. He just kept accumulating the wives, okay? And actually, in that sense, although the power dynamics behind marriage is similar to what's going on in Europe, in terms of the alliance making that underpins the marriage union, it's not just Bjarne Holgeir Bjarne. Although he does that as well on a couple of occasions. It's actually much more similar. He has more in terms of similarity to do with the Mughals or the Ottomans,
yeah.
For example.
Yeah. You
know? Like Akbar famously had hundreds of wives. The Ottomans also had many wives, many concubines, that kind of thing. And so, okay, I know that some people listening to this might be like, hang on a minute, how can you compare a Sikh Maharaja to a Mughal? But actually, I'm sorry, but we have to.
Yeah.
Because they're, in terms of the kind of political culture that Ranjit Singh is kind of embracing.
Inheriting. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at obviously where the Punjab is based in terms of geography, it is at the crossroads of that kind of Indo-Persian
world,
you know? So if he's projecting himself as a monarch, I mean, even his father and his grandfather, we seem to think had more than one wife, right? Not as many as he did. He took it to a whole other level. I'm not encouraging men out there to do this. Do not take this as a historical precedent for you to go and set up a harem. You also have to deal with all these Punjabi queens as well, by the way, if you try to do this, which even Ranjit Good Singh luck. Found challenging. Exactly. Yeah. But no, there was a real purpose to this, in that he then found allies, you know, throughout the Punjab. And he also then lent on his various in-law families, high and low in terms of social status, to build inroads for him into the local societies in which he was based. And you see Akbar do this very successfully, you know, in his period of reign. Of course, that matches up with Guru Arjan's time.
Yeah.
In terms of using that to really embed the Mughal dynasty within the kind of cultural world of South Asia and make it feel like a native dynasty rather than a foreign conquering thing. And obviously Akbar was born and brought up in India, the first of the Mughals to do so. So and Ranjit Singh really aligns himself with Akbar in lots of ways. Like there's actually quite a few manuscripts. He collected copies of the Akbarnama, the history of Akbar's reign. There's even a copy of the manuscript where he has a painting in there. One side is Akbar, and then there's another side is Ranjit Singh. So, you know, they're obviously fascinated.
I don't know whether it was in your book or in someone else's book. It mentioned that Maharaj Ranjit Singh Ji in his Toshkana had, apparently there were relics that were related to like to Muhammad or to the Prophet Muhammad. And so I don't know what you can say. Yeah,
I think that's been mentioned in a few. I can't remember exactly what, but various different artifacts he collected. One, because, you know, we do understand that he was interested in all religions, all faith. And all of these were represented at his darbar. And people were given the freedom to practice their own faiths. And charity was given across all types of religious institutions. But equally, you know, again, it falls back on this powers of politics of kingship, you know, for him to be able to claim such relics, hold on to such relics. Mm. And that could be seen as controversial in some ways. It was a measure of his power.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, definitely.
To hold that within his treasury.
No, definitely. You spoke actually just previously about kind of the martial imagery or like how women are kind of stepping into this martial. Hold on, let me rephrase that. A lot of the time, women during the Sikh Empire are seen as kind of things in the background almost. Literally people who are there as mothers or as wives, and that's about it. Obviously, you've just spoken about how that's just not the case and how there is a long list of women, Maharani Jindan being the last one almost, who buck this trend time and time again. In the grander scheme of things, in kind of like Ranjit Singh's empire as a whole, how else is this martial imagery deployed and developed? Because it from what you were saying about a lot of the women, it seems very much like a personal, as in they themselves have to kind of step up to the mantle and kind of take the bull by the horn, so to speak, rather than there being some type of kind of precedent that allows for it. It's almost like these women find themselves in these positions and continue to work through it rather than the system almost like encouraging that to happen. I don't know. I might be completely wrong.
I think I see it another way, actually. I think really the problem that we face in really kind of grappling honestly with a women's history of pre-colonial Punjab is that we just don't have the source material. Women are just not written about. They are either presented in a kind of, they're always written about by men, put it that way.
Yeah.
Whether it be chronicles or histories that are written at that time, or poetry or art, it's all done from the male perspective, vast majority of it, right?
Yeah.
But actually, if you think more, set it in broader terms, women were always active figures in South Asian society. If we limit ourselves to Sikh history alone, actually, we're left with quite a limited pool of sources.
Yeah.
But actually, ironically, if we borrow from Mughal sources, for example, or other sources from South Asia as a whole, you do find women's writing, you do find women's self-representation, and that helps us to put into context what is going on with Punjabi women of this period in a broader sense.
Yeah.
So for example, I've got one particular source in mind, which was an autobiography written by the sister of Babur, the first Mughal emperor, Princess Gulbadan Begum. And several of her female relatives also were asked by Babur to note down their own histories, essentially, which were later used as sources for the Akbarnama and other things, right? So one, that shows us that women were literate. But two, they also give us a glimpse into the active worlds in which these women lived, right? And they show women managing internal family diplomacy, running the camps that the royal entourages used to live in, right? Organizing the marriages, births, deaths, or whatever of the family, which were not just domestic events. They were important political events, right? In terms of dynastic succession and that kind of stuff, and keeping the balance, political balance, carefully under control. And on occasion, yes, stepping up in a martial kind of a way, whether it be one-to-one for personal defense or potentially for leading campaigns and that kind of stuff, right? Also engaging in trade and shipping and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. I mean, by the early modern period, you've got like Jahanara Begum, who's leading, you know, the trade with the East India Company and setting up ports and all sorts of stuff, right? Now, we tend to see, in terms of the kind of Orientalist, but also within South Asian, different, you know, Sikh Mughal clashes in our way we look at ourselves, we tend to think of Sikh and Punjabi women as more free than the Mughal women, right? If you think about it, there's a lot of stereotyping, particularly in Orientalist historiography, that shows royal women across South Asia at this time as locked away in a harem. And just living this very sensual life that supposedly only livens up when a guy comes to sleep with him, essentially.
Yeah.
The king or whoever else, right? And that's utter rubbish. When you look at the sources from this period, you see, whether they're Mughal sources or Punjabi sources, you see women actively going out and about and getting involved in politics and that kind of thing. So, okay, we can take some lessons from that broader context. But then if we return back to our core Punjabi Sikh sources from this period, then it helps us to really think about, hang on. We've been thinking about this with blinders on for way too long, right? And okay, we might only be working with these male-dominated sources where women appear in the odd phrase or the odd mention or whatever. But where we see that happen, we see it happen much more actively and interestingly. And it enables you to kind of actually break down the barriers of masculine and feminine in terms of martial representation much more actively, right? And whether it be written sources or artistic sources, you see where there's an overlap in the martial identity of men and women, right? So, okay, I find written men references to mine again sending cannonballs and whatever to her son to fight a campaign, right? But then I also came across paintings that she had commissioned at Shekhupura Fort, which was one of the forts that Garak Singh captured for, as I mentioned. And the paintings are like kind of the wallpaper, essentially, of her bedroom and her living room and that kind of stuff inside this fort. And okay, they're painted by men, but they also obviously were commissioned by her. So I'm guessing at some point she said to them, you know what I mean? I don't think she just let rip, right?
She told them off and got it corrected,
I don't know, but we hope so, right? I mean, if she was ballsy enough to be sending off cannonballs and leading troops and stuff, then I reckon she'd have told her painters how to do the bedroom. But some of these, so we don't have a written record of what she thought, but we can glean some of this from the paintings. And this is the kind of study that I tried to piece together in the first couple of chapters is, you know, what sort of image do we get of her as a woman, as a queen, as a mother from this set of paintings? And in there, you know, some of the pictures are reproduced in the book, so you can have a look. But some of them, well, the vast majority of them are available online for free on a website called asianarchitecture.com, which is not hard to find. they were taken, the photos were taken by this Pakistani Punjabi heritage photographer, Awan Ali. And, you know, as I was desperately scrambling to try and find sources during my PhD, and I was looking up at some of these historical sites that were being referenced in the sources, you know, these fragments here and there, I started looking around for more leads, right? And I looked up Shekarpura Fort, and, you know, ironically, that was the same fort later on that Maharani Jindagaur was imprisoned in, right? Famously, as we know. But this actually was the home of one of the leading Sikh queens for many years before that. And in the British sources, there's no link made. They just put Jindagaur under house arrest there and they treat it as a prison. What they don't reckon with is the fact that actually it was a bastion of power for a female queen over several decades. Of course it was going to be a site of rebellion for the Maharani at the end, right? Come on, she was probably laughing at them in a way. I mean, obviously she's never happy to be
sent away from them.
Yeah, she was never happy to be separated from the Leap Singh, but what a place to go, right? At the end, in all of this. But when you look at the paintings that do actually, thankfully, still exist, that Alan has taken photos of, the building itself is crumbling down, it's in ruins, we can't go there anymore. But the walls sing at us, you know, with these paintings. And they have depictions of the gurus there, Guru Gobind Singh as the warrior prince on a horse with a hawk and a dog hunting. You have also really one beautiful picture by a window I remember seeing of a young boy getting on a horse with his mother next to him. And I thought, I wonder if this is meant to be some sort of, you know, allegory of the Maharani's relationship with her son, Garak Singh, because that kind of relationship is echoed in the sources all the time, you know? And then there's other things. There's you know, lots of imageries of fruit and vegetation and that kind of thing, which points to fertility, which points to a flourishing countryside, right? But then there are parallels in the depictions of her and her household, but also with Ranjit Singh. So there's another series of famous pictures of him, but one in particular that's at the B&A, where he is riding on a horse through the countryside and he's accompanied by a retinue of soldiers. And it's a very martial image, but it's a subtle martial image because he holds onto a flower and the soldiers have got their weapons on them, but they're all wrapped up in rugs and fabric, right? Or very ornate with all sorts of gold speckles all over it. And that's in the V&A as well. And in the sources, the Punjabi sources, particularly the Courtly Chronicles, they mention how Ranjit Singh would come and stay with his Maharani at Shekarpura, right? Rather than her be holed up in a harem in Lahore, she had her own space. He would come and visit her and she would be running the state like a landowner. And so there's this kind of real interesting power couple relationship going on there, right? But there's paintings of him on these kind of country progresses. And on the face of it, we could see her representation as quite masculine and his is quite feminine. He's riding on a horse with a flower in his hand. But actually, that again speaks to us of the fluidity of these gender norms from this period, right? That he's powerful, but he's choosing not to display that power overtly. And actually, that makes him even more stronger as a result, right? That, you know, it's like, I'm not going to show you my full force, but I've still got it, right? And I can hold on to a flower and seem to be representing peace and prosperity to the kingdom. And in the same way, she's doing something similar. So it explodes our understanding of what is martial and the association of that with this kind of macho overt display of aggression that's particularly linked to a Punjabi Sikh in some ways.
Definitely.
So our understanding of what it meant to be a man or a woman or a Punjabi or a Sikh or a Sipahi or a Sardarni or whatever is hopefully opened up and becomes more sophisticated as a result. You see what I mean?
No, completely. We've actually answered the next question in this conversation already, which I really like. I absolutely love, because I was going to ask you, would it be fair to say that some of the misunderstandings around topics like women, just in general during this period, is a lot to do with a male dominated perspective? And you very much categorically have answered that. So like, I very much appreciate that. But could you kind of paint a picture for those listening, kind of what the cultural, social, economic landscape is briefly during the Sikh kingdom? And does Ranjit Singh do anything that drastically changes stuff, or is there any kind of influence that is felt from him in any particular way?
Well, I think, you know, if we take a broad sweep from the middle of the 18th century through to the 1830s, which is when Ranjit Singh is at the height of his power before he dies in 1839, I think you do see significant change. I mean, at a baseline, the Punjab, particularly on the eastern and central side, was always quite fertile, very obviously very agricultural. And with the rivers flowing through it, just this kind of cradle of trade and exchange of ideas, and a mixture of cultures, right? Because of course it's the entry point into between the kind of, well, it's like the Heathrow Airport, right? Of of connecting the rest of India to Afghanistan, Kashmir, you know, China, Tibet, as well as the Persianate world and that kind of stuff.
It's like the highway to the rest of the world almost.
Literally, yeah. And obviously a vast region in and of itself.
Yeah, massive. Sorry, I just wanted to ask you, could you describe to those listening how big Punjab is at this time? Because obviously today we are dealing with, I think, something like a tenth of the, or some ridiculous fraction of the original size.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, at the peak, the Sikh Empire at its peak, not only incorporated Indian Punjab as we see it today, but the vast majority of what Pakistan is, minus Kashmir, Jammu and Sindh regions, it kind of stretched northwest and had gobbled up bits of Afghanistan. So Peshawar and Jamrud, those cities were under Punjabi rule. And then up into, you know, even further north and east, Ladakh by the 1840s and bits of Tibet, again, were in the mountain passes, were in Sikh rule.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Now, we also have to think about the demographics of that population then that's under Sikh rule, right? So although we're talking about Sikh Raj, Sikhs are still in a minority in that region, you know, very much a minority. You have majority Punjabi and Punjabi Muslim and Hindus, but obviously then you have Pathans, you have Tibetans, you have Kashmiri, you know, the Dogra community in Jammu. You have all sorts of different people. And you also have significant numbers of nomadic peoples that are moving, you know, particularly in the 18th century. It's not just the Sikhs that took down Mughal and Afghan power. You have Rohilas, Gujars, all these kind of nomadic, kind of also quite martial communities that are disrupting, you know, the more settled life that certain Mughal elites, for example, or local ruling elites were trying to keep in place, in terms of, you know, guerrilla warfare. So and why are they there? Because for two reasons. Because of that trade artery that runs through Punjab, but also then the need for military labor.
Yeah.
It draws lots of people in that are from different parts of that world, Central and South Asia, because there is an easier place to either get a job as a soldier and settle down or engage in trade, right? And banking and that kind of stuff and make money. And then those people then want to settle on the land and start farming, right? Then they settle down. But there's a lot of cultural fluidity going on. And from Baba Nanak's time onwards, that also leads to all these different creative ideas about how to live and how to be a human and how to survive and deal with all the ups and downs of this life that we live, right? But what we see in Maharaja Ranjit Singh's time is that's I think people do look back on as a golden age, is that the entire region is not only, not the entire region, because the Punjab sort of south of the Sutlej River remains separate. It remains under the control of the Folkia clan. So three other different Sikh, eventually Maharajas, who then go under British indirect control. From 1809, so they stay separate, but the culture obviously is very much shared in many different ways. But the rest of the Punjab and then going outwards, northwards and eastwards, westwards, becomes under Sikh Punjabi rule. And that's the first time that you have seen so much of the region effectively ruled by an indigenous elite. Okay, yes, through the Mughal period and the Lodi period, these people are local too, but this is a kind of a homegrown dynasty, if you see what I mean, and very much built into the fabric of society in that way. And there's a sense of it's a very prosperous time, you know, and you really see that reflected in the levels of charity and education and in trade that goes on. And in the courtly culture that Ranjit Singh develops. But I have to say, there are always tensions boiling under the surface, you know, and people give a lot of credit to Ranjit Singh for supposedly keeping this all together. But I think he was getting on thin ice at times, you know, because if you think about, you know, the rise that we've just talked about, the competition within his family, the competition within the wider Mughals, as well as all these other different regional groups, right? And then the East India Company watching from the sidelines.
On his doorstep,
On the other side, right? You know, there's so much going on. This is a febrile political atmosphere at all times. So it's very much about a delicate balance of power constantly. So there's enormous wealth, enormous grandeur that is very rapidly embraced by the Sikh kings, as you rightly said.
Mm.
But there's always this tension underneath,
No, definitely. I think I did a quick Google whilst you were talking about that and answering that question. I don't know how accurate this is. This might be completely wrong, but it says that when Punjab came under British rule, it was a landmass. It had an area of 358,000 kilometers squared, which is absolutely massive. And apparently the size of Punjab today is 50,000 square kilometers. So I think we're talking it's like a 14th of the original size. So it gives you an idea to those listening how big this mass is that one king is ruling over. And also perhaps provide some context when you say some of the fringes of the empire aren't necessarily under direct rule, so to speak. It gets a little bit interesting towards the edges, I guess. So in chapter 3, it does a really brilliant job of kind of looking at the interactions between Ranjit Singh and the East India Company. And it's quite nuanced in how it approaches the topic and also kind of what's happening, whether Ranjit Singh can really see into the future and figure out what the British are doing. Because I think a lot of the time with hindsight, people are like, oh, Ranjit Singh should have told the British East India Company to piss off, and he should have kicked them out of India, and he should have done this and he should have done that. Because again, we very much concentrate on these like big characters rather than anything else. So we feel like they're superheroes who could have just changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for someone who has diligently studied the sources, and I think out of all of the chapters, this is probably the most interesting that I found. Although I loved all of it, but this was the top of it. But for those listening, how would you define the way Ranjit Singh engages, not with just the British East India Company, but also with, and you've kind of alluded to it slightly just previously, which is like, how is he dealing with this absolute manic political environment where, as you said, he's got Afghans on one side, he's got the British on the other side, he's got all the internal machinations going on in his own camp. Like, what defines his approach? How does he deal with these people?
Well, I think with it boils down to two things, isn't it? I think I've obviously made the argument about the dynastic colonialism side. And I think for me, time and time again, when I was looking at those sources, that vision of how he wants his lineage set up to rule for the future as the preeminent Mughal, the preeminent Khandan, that comes through, you know, a lot. And yes, people have criticized him for that. I don't say that he's good or bad for it. I just say that that's what I think happened. But then I think the approach to surviving and keeping that mission on track was keep your enemies close. And that seems to be the theme in his strategy all the time, you know, that he he's competitive. He's ruthlessly competitive. The way he sidelines other Punjabis, you know, who he once leaned on for help, is harsh.
Yes.
To say the least, you know. And that's something I obviously do tease out a lot in the book. But then he clearly identifies the British as a threat. And once he aligns with them, he sticks with them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting, that was quite shrewd and that was quite far-sighted in some ways that he did. But they weren't his sake by any means. And that we see evidence, you know, in the final chapters of the book in the 1840s, how they very quickly turn on his heirs. But he had many opportunities, actually, to ally up with other Punjabis, to tie up with the Gurkhas or the Marathas, various other groups in the subcontinent against the British, who approach him and say, look, come on, let's do this. And he doesn't. You know, he's very loyal to his alliance to the East India Company. And he really leverages it, I think, to bolster his authority in the Punjab. And you see that in the way that he sees off some of his early rivalries or kind of more needy relationships with some of the other members of the missile network that he's a part of, you know, how he plays Sadagur off against the British, how he plays his one of his mummy, one of the Bagh Singh of Jind, off against the British, you know. All of these kind of older generation political figures in the Punjab who, in some ways, had a claim on his success, and could have then used that claim to carve up the kingdom that he was trying to build, to set up, to continue their own mini kingdoms, as we were talking about before. He sees them off by saying, no, I'm going to be the preeminent Maharaja, and then I'm going to go toe-to-toe with the British, but I'm going to use that recognition also to solidify myself, you know? And in a way, I think it works better for the British to have one big man in charge than having to deal with the multiplicity of the Sikh Panth in some ways, because you see that in some of the early British writings about the Panth, that they don't understand what the Sikhs are about at all. They find it, you know, that whole divide and conquer thing, it's actually really hard for them to make sense of who the Sikhs are and what we believe in. And, but wait, who's the leader?
So some of the earliest like newspaper accounts that I came across from the British perspective of Sikhs is like just, like it's Bagheel Singh, it's Jassa Singh Ramgarhia, although they're calling him Jassa Singh Thokkar because that's his actual second name. And there's another character, I think it's Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, but again, they're referring to him by his original name rather than Ahluwalia. And again, they're very much like, all of these guys are in correspondence with us. Are they all our leaders? Are they all the leaders of the Sikhs? So you're completely right in terms of actually, it worked in the British interest almost, having one big figure to have to contend with or having to deal with, rather than loads of little people or multiple individuals.
What's interesting is that is where a lot of the republicanism talk comes in.
Yes.
As a label. If you look at some of those early sources, you will see that British writers are comparing the Sikhs to a republic, because that's the only way they can kind of get a handle on what is going on.
Moving then into chapter 4. So this focuses on, and I'm not about to try to pronounce it because I will absolutely butcher it.
I can't. I think I know what you're going to say, but I can't pronounce it either.
I'll read the English translation of the term, which is the crest jewel of the essence of all systems of astronomy. Yeah.
That's a mouthful enough.
Yeah, just in English, right?
Yeah.
I think, would the original have been in Sanskrit?
It was in Sanskrit, yeah. It's a text in the British Library with an extremely long title. I've never learned to read Sanskrit, and I don't even know, even if I did, I would still be able to pronounce this long word. But if you look up on Google, British Library, Crest Jewel of Astronomy, Sanskrit Manuscript, you'll see the title, and I will give £5 to anyone who can read that. I would start off on more, but my guy will hear.
You'll have loads of people recording themselves now and sending you the clips, hoping like, all right, where's my money in it?
Send it to me on Instagram.
proof dated and timed.
Exactly.
So chapter 4 focuses on this very hard to pronounce document, manuscript, which plays a central role in helping to redefine Kadak Singh, Sher Singh, Tara Singh and Dilip Singh. Now, you briefly just spoken about what it is, but could you kind of just explain a little bit about what it is, why it would have been made, and then how it helps in terms of revisiting these individuals, and what does it kind of remold? Like, what is it telling us that we perhaps weren't necessarily aware of before?
So just one of the things I think, I suppose, that links between the first chapter and this chapter that I like doing with this book is, and I think you picked up on it earlier when I said I don't know the answer to that question, is I don't know the answer to every question, right? And I think also, but it's kind of fun to throw big questions out there for people to think about. So I'm not trying to be a troublemaker or anything, but with the book,
every good troublemaker says that first, right?
with this book, I think there was some, you know, especially with it being my first book, at first when I was writing it, I felt pressure to be like, I need to answer these questions. I need to give people evidence or new understanding on some of the big questions that have been hanging around. But to an extent, I think I've personally had to make peace with the fact that, and I want others to feel more confident with this, my readers and anyone interested in history, no matter what period or topic that you're working on, is to be comfortable with the unknowns of history, right? And to then gain some wisdom from that process in itself. Because what's fascinating with this manuscript and with the history of Ranjit Singh's sons is how the manuscript can help us turn some of that story on its head. So this traditional, the regular narrative that you get is that when Ranjit Singh dies, he was the Sher of Punjab, the great line of Punjab that stitched together this golden era of Punjab for all of us, right? He calmed down all the fighting that was going on, supposedly, although obviously we said it was never that straightforward. And he, Superman, like, you know, brought the whole Punjab together, led it to glory. And then he died and it was a disaster and there was nobody that could touch his greatness ever since then. And his sons were useless, and one after the other, they either killed each other or they were fighting too much, and then the British just walked everything, right, and took everything over. Well, I think that's incredibly harsh. And I'm not saying that these sons were legends either, but I think there's somewhere in the middle that we need to be pitching for, you know, because think about just how crazy pressure it must have been anyway to have Ranjit Singh as your dad. I mean, just let that sink in for a minute.
Yeah, okay? Yeah. No, true.
Just, you know, and I mean, you know, in the early chapters of the book, obviously I started thinking about, well, actually, what do the sources tell us about what these boys were up to from Ranjit Singh's own lifetime? And as I mentioned earlier, at the age of 6, Gurdukh Singh is sent to go on missions to expand the empire. I mean, Bajar, like, that's a lot of
work. It's a lot of pressure.
There's a lot of pressure. God knows what he must have seen, but that was his duty, his responsibility as the heir to the throne of Punjab. Right? So not only is he doing that from the age of 6, but then we're also heaping on this pressure that he supposedly was an imbecile, an idiot, a terrible successor to his father. And I was like, where again is this messaging coming from? This idea that he was an imbecile. Where's the evidence for this, right? So you start looking at the wider sources. The Punjabi sources don't mention anything, but maybe they weren't going to mention anything because it would be embarrassing, right? But then there's so much evidence of things that he was doing, right? And the other princes. I was like, this is not adding up. If he was really that incapable, you know?
Yeah, why is he doing?
Why is he being sent to do these things, right? Then you start looking at the British colonial sources, which is where this messaging comes out the most strongest, right? And actually there's a divide within that, okay? There's a divide. And the sources that claim he's an imbecile build on one another, but many of them are not written by people that directly come into contact with Gurdukh Singh, okay? Which is crucial. It's crucial, you know? If you want an eyewitness account, it's crucial. It's just passing on secondhand gossip. Okay?
Yeah, it's hearsay. It's completely.
This is it. But this is what that Orientalist narrative is built about, on built out of, right? You actually look at sources that have from British writers that had met Gurdukh Singh. For example, this one text in particular that I quote from a guy called Claude Martin Wade, who was the leading Punjab British agent to the Punjab from the East India Company. He's actually very sympathetic to Gurdukh Singh. And what was interesting was, is he says that, and I'm paraphrasing, but he's talking about the potential succession struggle that the British start to speculate might happen when Ranjit Singh dies. And he says that, look, actually, I've met Gaurav Singh a fair bit, you know, when I've gone to different events and meetings and, you know, diplomatic discussions in the Punjab. He's not a bad guy. You know, he's quite nice. But the thing is, they say he's soft. He's weak. He's a softer character. He's not like in your face. He's very gentle, you know. And actually, there's a potential that Ranjit Singh is jealous of him, his own dad, right? He's jealous of him because he's actually popular, right? Yeah, he's quite popular. No one's got a bad thing to say about him, apart from these British gossips.
Yeah.
Right? And actually, then when you... And I was like, blimey, that's the turn up for the book, right?
That's a game changer.
And then when you look back at the Punjabi Persian sources, for example, Sohan Lal Suri's Chronicle.
Yeah.
What you see is Gaurav Singh repeatedly in the 1830s volumes complaining to his father and saying, look, I'm doing everything you're asking me to do, right? And you're still giving me a hard time. And what's interesting is there's a very clearly sad dynamic between grandfather, father, and grandson, right? So Ranjit Singh, Gaurav Singh, and then Gaurav Singh's son, Nor Nihal Singh. Nor Nihal Singh is held up in much Punjabi history writing as the real ideal successor to Ranjit Singh, right? And we know it's well evidenced that Ranjit Singh dotes on Nor Nihal Singh. What's interesting is that Gaurav Singh in these Punjabi sources often complains that Ranjit Singh is spoiling his grandson, right? And that Nor Nihal Singh, you know, Gaurav Singh's trying to tell his own son off and it's not going down very well. There's one story that I came across in Sohan Lal Suri's anecdote where Nor Nihal Singh complains about a jagir, or first a jagir that he's been given, but also a mission that he's being sent on. And he says, I don't want to go. I don't want to do that, right? I'm not happy about it. And he's not happy with the jagir that he's been given. He doesn't see it as good enough.
Yeah.
And Gaurav Singh says to his dad, Ranjit Singh, why are you letting this go? He is being a brat.
Yeah.
You know?
Why aren't you disciplining him?
This is it, right? Yeah. This is not okay. And there's no response, right? Because obviously Gaurav Singh must have had it hard growing up, right? Yeah. His generation. And suddenly Nor Nihal Singh's getting away with murder by the sound.
He can do what he wants, yeah.
Yeah. And this is there's no answer. There's obviously a bit of a jealousy between father and son, right? I was like, whoa, okay. And then when you look at this manuscript that's in the British Library, this extremely hard to pronounce manuscript that we won't name, but nevertheless, folks, that is absolutely stunning. So it's well worth going to have a look at. You can order it through the special collections at the India Office, at the Asian African Studies Centre in the British Library. And inside this manuscript, it is a detailed study of astronomical science, right? The study of astronomy. And it pulls together the latest ideas from Islamic, European, as well as Indian thinking about astronomy, right? So it's essentially like a kind of a latest textbook in some respects. And it's got some stunning paintings in there, including of the gurus, Guru Nanak and Guru Gobind Singh Ji, and then also of various different Punjabi Sikh figures, right? And it's interesting because in the catalogues at the British Library, as well as on the British Library's own website, you know how I just mentioned to you there's a discrepancy within the colonial sources about what was Gaurav Singh like? Well, in the sources, in the catalogue records of, you know, that have been written over various decades in the 20th century to now of this book, there's a debate about, well, there's confusion, essentially, about who commissioned this manuscript. Because it's obvious that it was a Sikh person who commissioned it.
Yeah.
And it's obviously was a very expensive manuscript to be commissioned. It was actually put together by a Sanskrit scholar based in Varanasi.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show the knowledge networks. Yes, in which Punjabi elites were embedded, that they were not only sitting in Punjab and conquering and whatnot, but they were interested in books, for one, interested in astronomy specifically, and interested enough to know that there's scholars sitting in Benares who they should pay to produce these beautiful manuscripts for them, right? So, I mean, come on, there's a lot to unpack there, right? But the interesting thing is that there's a confusion about who commissioned this. And the credit for a long time well, more recently, has gone to Lena Singh Majithia, who was a very learned Sikh Sardar, one of the chief noble families of the region at the time, but who was known to be very interested in science and engineering, right? So it makes sense that he would have been a potential patron of this book, right? But actually, earlier sources that have pulled information from the text have suggested actually, no, it was Gurdip Singh, right? And now if in the British sources, he is repeatedly referred to as an imbecile, okay? We're not gonna ever think that he was the guy to have commissioned this very specialist, very intellectual text, okay? But the catalogue, one of the earlier catalogues, mentions a whole story around this, that Gurdip Singh commissioned it. He asked this scholar to come to Punjab and bring it to him when it was ready. He actually commissioned it as a gift for his son, Nor Nihal Singh.
Yeah.
But when Nor Nihal received this scholar, once he reached the Punjab, Gurdip Singh had been kind of put under house arrest, or was definitely very ill, and then stepped back from the Darbar. This is after Ranjit Singh has died. And Nor Nihal Singh angrily tells this guy to get lost. He's not interested, right? So what was a present from his dad, he rejects it, essentially. And then this guy, the scholar, Dayanand, he quickly has to scramble to find somebody else, because God knows how much it cost him to put together this manuscript, right? It's not that he's obviously gone out of pocket to do it until, you know, like, I know it cost me time and money to put my research and put my book together and everything else. He's waiting for someone to pay him, right?
Yeah.
And that's when he turns to Lena Singh Majithia. And it's interesting because, as the commentators on this manuscript have claimed, the painting of Majithia that's in the book is clearly done later on. It's of a slightly different style and looks more rushed than the one. It's still very beautiful and very fine, but it's not quite the same as the ones of the gurus and the other earlier passages, okay? So that's fascinating, because what it does is it gives us a complete, I mean, we don't know 100%. This is the thing, our knowledge is imperfect. There's lots of question marks around it. But what it does is, you know, with the kind of broader picture of Gurdip Singh that I was trying to tease out from these different sources of his entire trajectory of his life, as well as of the other princes and the kind of pressures that they were put under, which then also explains their quite fractious relationships.
Yeah.
You know, when you chuck this manuscript into the mix, it really does show a very different picture of who they were as men, you know, and as people. So I think, and it also shows Punjabi culture to be less of the kind of crude jatgar, you know, anbar thing that we also sometimes, I think, are a bit too quick to label ourselves with. It's a bit
stereotype.
Too easy. Whether it's from external jokes about Sikhs and Punjabis, or whether it's just our lazy way of saying nay nay, as he pardon earlier. Actually, there's so much going on there, you know? And if I can just return to that imbecile word. Even in the 19th century, actually, if you look up that word, because words, the meaning of words also change all the time. You look up the root of that word and how it was being used in the 19th century, the word imbecile and the word idiot were actually medical terms. And they meant someone that had a cognitive disability, sometimes also a stutter, right? So there is reference in the writings of Alexander Burns that Gurdip Singh may have had a speech impediment, that he didn't speak very well, and that he stuttered, and that he sounded like an idiot, right?
But did
that mean that he was not intelligent? We don't know. This is the thing. But what fragments we have, right, they're not internally consistent. They're actually very interesting. And maybe there's a possibility that he may have been in some way, either cognitively or, you know, verbally handicapped. But nevertheless, as a person, as a potential ruler, as a person of intellect, there was still a lot going on with him.
Yeah.
You know?
Mad.
And quite possibly a much loved figure within Punjabi society, if not potentially between his own father and son. So in my own way, I don't know with Gurdip Singh, he's a big question mark, but my heart started to break for him a little bit as I read a bit more about his story, because I think he's been misunderstood, potentially. And I think that's why I chuck these things out as questions now rather than as definitive answers, because I was grabbed, as I talked about it in the previous episode, by the story of the Maharani Jindal, and that led me into all of this, right? But if someone listening to this today is equally grabbed by the story of Gurdip Singh or whoever else, go and learn and do the research, because you just don't know when we start asking these questions what more light we might shed. Like, you might turn around and say to me, no, Priya, you got it totally wrong about Gurdip Singh. Your theory is the quas, and actually he was a plum. But I will happily accept it if we have
evidence. He's a plum,
you know?
He's a plum. I love that. No, completely. I think your approach is completely correct in terms of, like, if you can just kind of spark one person's interest and they go off and discover something else and they can add to the conversation or to the debate, like, more the merrier. That's kind of, well, it's the whole point of academia, really. It almost kind of evolves off the back of whatever's come previous to that. I've got to the last question. And as always, I've kept the easiest question to the end, which is, in a nutshell, why did the Sukra Chakya dynasty fall apart? And I purposefully phrase it within those terms, the Sukra Chakya dynasty, because, and I had to actually change the question because it was the Sikh Empire. But the more that I've been reading lately, the Sikh Empire is more of like it's more of a term that we use to almost romanticize that period of time. He was Sikh, obviously, and therefore by default it was a Sikh empire, but it was very much his empire. And as you were saying, about what was it, dynastic colonialism, like, it was a dynasty. Like, his grandfather and his father had carved huge bits of land out that he inherited, so it wasn't like he did this all on his own. However, that's the beginning. Coming to the end, in a nutshell, and I know that's really, really, really kind of asking a lot because it is a huge question, obviously, but, like, a lot of people, as you said kind of towards the beginning, they view Maharaja Ranjit Singh Ji as being this great big character. He's the one who's holding everything together. He's the one that, once he's dead, there's no one there to kind of hold everything together, and it just crumbles and falls apart. However, a more nuanced view would say something completely different. So what's going on, and why does that crumble?
I mean, it is a big question. Ranjit Singh was a big character. No matter what I say, he still will be, and he is rightly a big character. I think, you know, whether we call it the Sukra Chakya dynasty or the Sikh Empire, both terms are terms that we have in modern times come to apply to this kingdom, to this period of Sikh Raj. Obviously, neither of those were used directly by Ranjit Singh or his people at the time. They, of course, refer to themselves as the Sarkar Khalsa. So we have to take the Sikh part of it, the Khalsa part of it, seriously, even if the political reality was complex and maybe not as Puratan Khalsa as we might want it to be, right? Yeah. But then I think, as we have discussed today, the pure Khalsa thing has always been a far more complex, you know, even before Ranjit Singh, than perhaps we would like to think about. And I think that is part and parcel of the struggle that we face as Sikhs in grappling with our history, as we've repeatedly touched on today, is that we like to, I think because our community, our bond has struggled as much as it has, we lean really heavily on mythologizing our history and on putting some of our great historical figures on pedestals, because I think there's real pain behind that desire to do that. It's that we want these heroes to hold on to make ourselves feel stronger, you know? But it doesn't seem to get us anywhere. You know, it's quite a, because we can, as humans, can never live up to those models, and nor can those figures themselves, really. They're often more complex than we make them out to be, right? So I think with the fall of the Sukra Chakya dynasty, Sikh Empire, whatever you want to call it, I mean, the sort of arguments that I laid out in the book, but I think I'm still thinking about this as well. In terms of the top level, the dynasty, I think to an extent, there's a series of historical contingencies that contribute to this, right? And it was never inevitable. That's the argument that I make in the book, that it was never inevitable that dynasty, that family was going to collapse. I think the and I think Ranjit Singh himself had mapped out a succession plan that he obviously thought was going to work out just fine, right? Because he had Gorakh Singh, who was still young and pretty healthy, and then he had, although there's considerations that he may have been a fairly sickly man, and then there was Nur Nihal after him.
Yeah.
And Nur Nihal already had married a couple of times by the time that Ranjit Singh died. So there was no likelihood that in terms of a kind of hereditary succession.
Yeah. It wasn't like a Henry VIII situation where he's like desperately trying to find an heir or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not just those two. Of course, there were all of the other princes, Sheer Singh, Dara Singh, the other younger boys, right? That Ranjit Singh had either fathered himself or had acknowledged as princes and sons within that wider family. And I think that obviously was, again, a part and parcel of having more members of the dynastic colonial project to put to work in his own lifetime, but also for the safeguarding of the longevity of the kingdom, right? No one foresaw that Gorakh and Nur Nihal would die within 17 months of Ranjit Singh himself. That was a killer blow in and of itself, right? But for me, the turmoil that comes into play when Sheer Singh, the son of Mehtab Kaur, Ranjit Singh's first wife, the reputed son of Ranjit Singh, clashes with Gorakh Singh's widow, Maharani Chand Kaur, that adds a new level of toxicity to Punjabi politics, because you have this battle between illegitimacy, you know, who is a legitimate heir in terms of bloodline versus gender, right? And there had always been this uneasy tension in terms of the role of the woman within the Punjabi politics that Ranjit Singh, of course, had battled with Sada Kaur and other women. That these women clearly felt that they were entitled to have a political role, have a martial role, but they were being pigeonholed into the role that Ranjit Singh was prepared to allow them to have within his wider imperial project, right? And that blocks off. That means that his will, his dynastic will, is the thing that shaped politics, not individual people's talents and energies and that kind of stuff. And that toxicity that comes about in terms of who is legitimate, who is it a man or a woman, is it this relation to Ranjit Singh or that relation to Ranjit Singh, that unleashes all sorts of tension. And the fact that they literally go to war with each other, right? So that means that the army is split, they're paid off. Now, that's not to say, again, that is the end of that Punjabi kingdom, because actually, if you look throughout South Asian history, and again, if you look back to the Mughals or you look to the Ottomans or other kingdoms of this period, there's actually lots of research being done to show, for example, there's one book by Muniz Faruqi, Princes of the Mughal Empire, that shows how actually these conflicts in the long term could end up ironically strengthening the kingdom, strengthening the dynasty, once that battle of succession has been fought and won and stabilized, then the people that were on other sides, you know, like Ranjit Singh was doing, if you actively go out to them with an olive branch and say, look, you're under my rule now, so you better behave, but I'm going to give you some territory, I'm going to give you a responsibility, I'm going to give you some status, nevertheless, they come back in the fold, right? And or you're on different sides, you've got to go and find new alliances and you've got to bring them in. It could have worked, but the other factor on all of this, of course, is the adding to the turbulence of the waters is the East India Company. And they did not have the respect for the kingdom and the dynasty that Ranjit Singh hoped that they would have had, I think. Maybe he was aware of this, but he clearly thought that he had set up a relationship for generations to come. And they're not interested. And of course, the East India Company's internal politics, as we've discussed today, changes all the time as well, you know? I think there was a potential, had Dalhousie, the last governor general of this period, had he not come to power, had, say, Henry Harding and Henry Lawrence stayed in control of the Punjab, I think potentially it would have still lived on as a princely state for quite some time under Daleet Singh, quite possibly, because both Henry Lawrence and Henry Harding were wary of taking over the entirety of the Punjab. And Henry Lawrence in particular, who becomes one of the famous administrators of the Punjab, who wrote several novels and histories of the Punjab, who was kind of obsessed with it, to be quite honest. he really thought that British India would be better off ruled as a kind of a partnership between the company and the Indian princes, and that therefore the British wouldn't have to rule dependent on a native force. Indian army.
Yeah,
and force, essentially. He thought it should be some sort of partnership. And he was kind of tipped to eventually become a governor general had he not died off quite young. So a lot of these kind of accidental or historically contingent deaths kind of lead the way, you know, because both within Punjabi politics or British politics, ideas and arguments were not set in stone. There was lots of internal debate going on, and that meant things could go either way. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a tragic set of political, unfortunate events that
circumstances
eventually lead to the demise.
Hmm.
But nothing was inevitable.
No, definitely. I loved how you ended with probably like one of the biggest open-ended conclusions, which is how had it been a different person from the British side, things could have been drastically different. And I'm doing my utmost not to dive further into that and continue the podcast. But you've obviously piqued my interest, and I'm sure people listening. I just wanted to say thank you for making the time to do today's podcast. We've got through all of the questions that I had planned for this little section. Otherwise than that, I will leave you to the rest of your day.
Keep doing what you're doing. It's absolute greatness. All right. And more power to your podcast. I hope it.
Oh, no, completely. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. And yeah, again, everyone, if you haven't, please go follow Priya on her various social medias. I think it's just Dr. Priya Atwal on Twitter and Instagram.
Yes. Priya Atwal on Twitter and Dr. Priya Atwal on Instagram.
I will leave it to the rest of your day. Thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.